Welcome to Catholic Radio Indy's Lunchtime Podcast Sampler. I'm Kent Blanford. Each week, we'll bring you a sampling of some of the best Catholic podcasts being prepared and shared out there on the internet. UFOs are in the news again, with Congress holding hearings about what the government knows about them. How should Christians feel about this issue? What does the Catholic Church teach? And how do we make sense of it? The good folks from the Considering Catholicism podcast take on that challenge.
If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism. Well, welcome back to the podcast, Corey.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's always great to have you because you're so knowledgeable and informative and you know so much stuff. And
why it's are you great. Flattering me, Greg?
Oh, no, well, yeah, because I want you to buy lunch. No, you're really good at it. I'm looking forward to our conversations today because we're going to have a couple of really interesting and I think in some ways kind of unusual conversations.
These are the kind of conversations I like having.
Yeah, I know. These are really fun. These are going to be super fun conversations and you're a great reference for things because you research things really well and you're a library of information. So let's get into the first of these two sort of unusual conversations.
Okay.
We're going in a weird place today. Today, we're going to talk about UFOs.
Yes.
Unidentified flying objects.
Or some people may have heard a newer term, UAPs, which is unidentified aerial phenomenon. I think the people in the government just got a little testy about the bad reputation of UFOs. And they're like, no, it's totally different. It's UAPs. They're different. It's honestly.
It is. And the reason we're talking about this is that there's been this renewed, well, there's always been interest in them and it kind of comes and goes, ebbs and flows. And we'll talk about that a little bit in this conversation because I think it's interesting that interest in this thing has these kinds of ebbs and flows.
Sure.
I remember when I was younger and it was like super hot. You had movies like E.T. and you had, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And then for a while, nobody talked about it. And then all of a sudden it came back with like Independence Day, which was a great movie, by the way. And then it kind of went away and it sort of comes and goes. But the reason we're talking about this is in the last, I don't know, 12 to 24 months, it's all back in the news again.
Right.
And you actually have some Congress people and others that are, have been holding these congressional hearings. Mm-hmm. And you have these supposed whistleblowers coming forward saying the U.S. government has all of this information and even making claims in these congressional hearings that the U.S. government has alien spacecraft in warehouses and alien creatures or bodies in warehouses. I know I saw this in the movie Independence Day. And so they're saying that this is all true, but then others are like, well, where are they, right? And they're like, well, it's a giant government conspiracy or something, right? So the reason I wanted to talk about this is that if you're even looking at the internet, the news or whatever, this is all creeping up again. And it's introducing maybe some confusion for Christians or Catholics as to what they're supposed to think about this.
Sure, sure.
Now, my personal take, because I'm who I am, is I think that that's partly intentional. There's a term, PSYOP, P-S-Y-O-P, psychological operation. And I feel like this is kind of a PSYOP from kind of, I think, anti-Christian forces to like flood the news with this right now and flood the news zone to distract us from other things. But I tend towards the conspiracy theorist.
And I don't know how much credence I'd give to that particular PSYOP theory. I think there's other options as well, but okay. that is one of them.
Well, we'll get into it. So, but I want to talk about it because I do think there's a lot of people going, well, what am I supposed to think? Mm-hmm. Because they're probably hearing about this stuff and that the U.S. government, that, you know, here when you have senators holding hearings or whatever and talking about, we're going to open the government warehouse and bring E.T. out. Let's talk about it today. All right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Let's do it.
Now, I want to organize our conversation so it doesn't get crazy and ridiculous into
That's a good idea.
Yeah, into sort of three categories. I want to first, kind of Roman numeral one, talk about whether or not within Catholic theology or a Catholic worldview or Catholic doctrine, there is the possibility for life on other planets. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going to talk about that a little bit.
Right.
Then I want to turn from that to the cultural phenomenon itself. I personally think what's more interesting about this is the interest.
I think
that the cultural phenomenon is more interesting than the actual phenomenon. You know, the unidentified aerial phenomenon, in my opinion, are less interesting than the fascination with the phenomenon.
Sure.
And then the third thing I want to talk about is what possibly are these things within the context of a Christian worldview and particularly maybe a Catholic worldview.
Yeah.
So that's where I want to go.
Okay. Right?
So let's do this. Roman numeral one. Does the Catholic Church have a dogma or doctrine or teaching about life on other planets?
The short answer would be no, not as such. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that we can't say anything about it from a Catholic perspective, and plenty of people have in very faithful ways. This actually goes back to some of the things we talked about recently, talking about evolution. I mean, we can make some basic premises that if there is life, intelligent or otherwise, on other planets, it was created by God, it is known by God, it is within the providence of God. If it's intelligent, then it's presumably made in the image of God. And so that is a baseline for if these kinds of life forms existed. Otherwise, it's based on evidence. We don't have, like, the scriptures don't tell us one way or the other whether God did that. It doesn't really affect directly the message that is being given to us by the scriptures. And so it's in the realm of scientific observation, whether we can find such a life form or not. And as far as I know, no one has presented definitive evidence yet. But if they did, it would not sort of knock over the Christian understanding of the universe as we have from scripture and tradition.
Right. Well said. So, like you say, there's no dogmatic teaching on it. There's no doctrine on it. You've got a copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church on the table between us.
That's for the next episode.
Right, that's the next episode. But that's for the next episode because there's nothing in there about aliens.
Exactly.
And so the question often gets asked as a hypothetical, and you can't sort of answer hypotheticals in that way. So in other words, as you said, and I'm just going to try to summarize it, what we do know is that all things are created not only by God, but that Colossians tells us that all things were created through Christ and in Christ and for Christ.
Right.
And that word in Greek, all things, is all things in the universe.
The cosmos. Yeah.
The cosmos. So if there is another planet, it was created by Christ. And if there are life forms on it, if there are creatures on it, then they were created by Christ for the glory of God.
Exactly.
Right? Yes. We know that that is actually a dogmatic statement because it comes directly from scripture, multiple places, including Colossians 1.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's irrespective of where the life or the planet is. I mean, that's true of Earth. That'd be true of anywhere.
Right. So like we're sort of kind of coming up with a taxonomy of belief here. Mm-hmm. We say dogmatically, we know that God created the heavens and the earth, that Christ, the efficient agent of that was the second person of the Trinity, Christ, who created all things in him for him, and all things add up to his glory, and in the end he will remake all things
right
to the glory of God. So then you ask a sort of second order question. Well, hypothetically, what could be included in all things, right? And you say, well, is it possible that in all things, among those all things, might be a creature living on another planet? Well, I can't, you know, the church, logically, you can't rule that out. As you say, we have no evidence to think there is. No one has demonstrated or proved that there's some life on another planet. But if you ask, and people have asked, they've asked the popes, they asked Pius XII, because a lot of this stuff, we'll talk about that in a minute, arose during his pontificate, the first sort of UFO claims.
Sure, in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah, and then they asked John Paul II, and both the popes and others have answered it exactly out of the way. Well, I can't, you're asking me a hypothetical, and I can't say that I can't say that there aren't fairies that dance on the lawn. It'd be like saying before the flood, were there unicorns? Well, I can't say that there weren't any unicorns.
But I also can't observe that time period to find out.
Right. Are you asking me, are there unicorns? I don't know. I guess there could have been. Is it possible that somewhere in this world there is a closet, and when you go through the coats at the closet, you end up in another place where there are talking beavers?
I'd like to think so, but...
I know. Well, right. And for those of you who are like, what are you talking about? It's like the Chronicles of Narnia, right? Mm-hmm. You go, well, I can't prove that there isn't a closet somewhere that mm-hmm. leads to the land of talking beavers. But so, yeah, I guess that's broadly possible. And if there were talking beavers through a door, they would be created by Christ, in Christ, for Christ.
Right. And at some point, we have to also talk about plausibility.
Right.
I mean, different things can be possible, but they're not all equally probable. And that's what a lot of the conversation around life on other planets operates on, is how likely is it that there would be other planets that are like Earth that could sustain life, that it could develop there? And that's all, those are all scientific questions that are at the stage of debate and speculation, because we don't have the solid evidence.
Okay. And this sort of leads me, well, before I'm, okay, a sidebar on this, and we'll get to this in a minute, mm-hmm. or maybe we'll or won't, but I mean, we could do a whole episode on this.
Sure.
But if there were creatures on another planet, there's a whole nother category of question. They would have been created by Christ, in Christ, for Christ.
Right.
But they may be fallen or unfallen.
Yeah, that is another big question.
That's a whole nother question.
And that's even more speculative.
Yeah, and people have speculated on it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have, going back to C.S. Lewis, you have his wonderful trilogy, which we need to do for book
club.
Yeah,
we'll have to do the space trilogy.
The space trilogy, where he speculates that there are these other planets, and on them, there are some creatures, some planets that have, in a sense, fallen like Earth into sin, and maybe there's some that haven't fallen into sin. Mm. And actually, he goes back with that to the old doctrines, because Dante and Thomas Aquinas and others speculated about whether or not there's a possibility of other worlds and other creatures that would be unfallen or whatever.
As modern or postmodern people, we like to think that all our ideas are original, but people have been speculating about this kind of thing forever, even if they weren't necessarily thinking in terms of other planets. Sometimes they were, sometimes they weren't, but, you know, just the whole globe hadn't been explored in a lot of times, and there was speculation about what other kinds of creatures could exist on the other side of the world.
You go back to the Middle Ages, and there's all these weird things about, you know, there's islands with headless people, but Pegasuses and, you know, whatever, right? Mythological creatures and all that. And that's why I don't want to spend too much on it, because it's all speculative. People come to you and go, well, what about this? And what about this? And what about this? And like I said, well, yeah, what about Pegasuses? And what about, you know, I mean, flying horses and talking beavers and all that kind of stuff? Yeah, we can talk all day long about possibilities, but there's no particular reason. But I want to go into our second sort of Roman numeral, because you made an important point about other planets and the probability. Because when you go back and follow the history of UFOlogy, it's interesting that it starts around the 1940s.
In its present form,
In its present form. Now, prior to that, and that's why I think it's interesting to talk about this other term, unexplained aerial phenomenon. Mm. There have always been unexplained aerial phenomenon, right? That's why the ancient Greeks would say, well, it's Apollo pulling his chariot across the sky, or different religions would have different explanations, largely supernatural explanations.
Or they'd be taken as omens or whatnot,
Or they would just speculate about mythological creatures, flying horses or whatever, right? Mm. And so there's always been things in the sky that people couldn't explain. But what's interesting around the late 30s, going into the 40s, is that the explanation shift from being supernatural in nature, sort of supernatural mythology, to having this concept that they're from other planets and they're alien life that have traveled here in spaceships. And what's interesting is it coincides with our own technological capacities, that as soon as we started developing airplanes and rockets, you know, the Germans launching V2s on London during the Blitz and Wernher von Braun and all this kind of stuff, right? As soon as we started doing Sputnik, all of a sudden there was a shift in the cultural explanations to these things from being supernatural mythology to now being, as we, this speculating that, well, just as we are developing rockets, maybe other people or creatures develop rockets and have flown here.
Right, right.
And the question is were there actually more unexplained aerial phenomenon beginning in the 40s than there were in the 1840s or 1740s or 640s? Was there actually an increase of this stuff or more evidence, or did our, from a cultural standpoint, did we just construct a new sort of mental frame or mythology for how to explain them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a excellent point to what you just said. And it's not to say that we have to take a position even on whether there are aliens and whether any of these unexplained era phenomenon truly are aliens. We could say maybe some of them are, maybe some of them aren't, but the interpretative lens that people have brought to it has definitely gone over a tipping point at the middle of the 20th century. It's not that nobody speculated about it beforehand. There certainly were people who did, but that has become sort of the dominant way of seeing these things. And as you said, it's situated within a largely, or at least sort of by default, materialist understanding of the universe. It's that matter stuff is all there is. There might be untold space out there and untold planets and stars and everything, but there's nothing transcendent, God or angels or non-physical spirits. And so aliens are something situated within that. They're biological creatures like us that can be used as something to explain these phenomena. And so I think you're right about that shift happening in the 20th century. As an interesting side note to that, I think in some ways it's a modern twist on an ancient pagan understanding of the universe. Because if you actually go back and look at Greek mythology or Norse mythology or any of the old pagan mythologies, their understanding of the gods and demigods and what we would maybe call supernatural creatures was actually quite naturalistic in it. It wasn't explained. They didn't have the experimental method to be like, okay, here's how we deduce whether Zeus or Pegasus exists and how they operate or something. But the gods arose out of the primordial chaos of the universe, out of matter pre-existent to them. The gods didn't create ex nihilo, out of nothing, the universe like the God of the Jews and of the Christians did. So yeah, it might be the gods and demigods and such like might be far beyond us and mysterious and hidden and all of those kinds of things, but they're still within a material framework within the universe that's made of stuff and not spirit and things beyond. And so you, in some ways, you're returning to that kind of mindset where if the gods and such like become an operative explanation for mysterious phenomenon, and then you, now in the modern period, you have aliens as being that default explanation.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying is that the old way of looking at it, or the ancient pagan way of looking at it, is that they exist within the cosmos. Mm-hmm. They didn't create the cosmos.
Right, and they're not over it. Yeah,
The Jewish-Christian concept was really radical in the sense that the Jewish God, and then, of course, the Christian God, is the creator of the cosmos. The Greek and Roman gods weren't creators of it. They were part of it. But I think there's another thing going on, and that is, for lack of a better word, your conceptual framing or your conceptual template. And so if you go back prior to the 20th century, mid-20th century,
sure,
you had a sort of religious framing to these things, or at least a sort of, for lack of a better word, supernatural religious framing. So let me give you an example, the difference between astrology and astronomy.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So you would say 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago or whatever that the planets through astrology exert, you know, these kinds of forces,
influences,
right? And so everything lives within this sort of religious frame. And you could have angels and demons and ghosts and mythological creatures, but particularly let's stick with the angels and demons part of it, which are creatures, to your point, not material creatures, but they're creatures that live within the created universe. But you had a religious sort of frame to it. Now, what happens in the mid-20th century is, I think, two things. Number one, we develop technological capacities. So now we start developing telescopes and the capacity to study other planets better than we ever had before. We start developing rocket technology. And eventually, you know, the Russians put Sputnik in the sky. We put a man on the moon, right? And all this kind of stuff. So the but simultaneously with that is the death of religion in the West, right? So you have, for a thousand reasons, you had critical biblical theory, you had all of this, and what the 19th century German critical religious scholars were doing is demythologizing the Bible, demythologizing the universe. So it's what you're saying about it stuff being kind of within the universe, but more than that, it's coming up with what they would have called a scientific explanation.
Right.
So what happens is you go, okay, there's lights in the sky. Before that, you would have framed what those lights in the sky were through sort of a religious lens. Mm. Now you say, well, that's just silly. I mean, we all know that that's not true. We now know much more scientifically that they must be creatures that have flown here for 200 light years away in little spacecraft. And there's no more evidence that nobody's been able to produce that they're creatures that have flown here in a spaceship any more than there may have been evidence to prove that they were angels or demons. But now we have a different frame for how we look at the universe, and we feel much more confident framing things not only in, like you say, within the created universe, but within this scientific explanation. So I guess what I'm trying to say is our mythology has shifted from being a religious mythology to a scientific mythology.
Yeah, I think that's essentially right. And I think where we as Catholics have to step in and synthesize here is what we talked about in our episode about science and religion, or science and faith, is that this, what the takeaway here shouldn't be that old religious or mystical mythology was good and the new scientific mythology is bad. What we should take away from this is that science is good. It is a logical and legitimate way of looking at the universe. When you turn it into a mythology or a totalizing way of explaining the universe, and so something couldn't possibly be supernatural, therefore it must be aliens, or it must be something like that. Science has gone wrong and has gone beyond its mandate. And you could also make legitimate criticisms about older religious mythologies, even within a Christian context, that they didn't pay adequate attention to actual scientific observation and those sorts of things. And in some ways, it's good that we have moved beyond those, but that doesn't mean that what sort of the popular atheist rhetoric would say is that because we've explained so many things through science that we've debunked faith. It's what we talked about before, that faith and science are working together. We should avoid these extremes of mythology and of ideology in both directions.
Okay. Again, I'm fascinated in some sense by not only the cultural, but the psychological component of this. Mm. Because I think there's something in 20th century something happens in us around the middle of the 20th century. And remember the other things that are going on. Again, the Nazis are inventing V2 buzz bombs and nuking London, and you got Wernher von Braun, and then you have Sputnik, and you have the atomic bomb, and you know all this stuff. And there is this shift to science as a psychological comfort. Mm-hmm. So what happens is, if you can explain something, if you can concoct a rationalization that is framed in a scientific, so a guy in a lab coat is explaining it with a chalkboard rather than a priest at the front of the room, that is psychologically more comforting to man in the latter part of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century.
Yeah, there's definitely a large degree to which the trust of the public has moved towards people perceived as scientists rather than religious leaders.
Yeah, I would say trust, but it's even deeper than that. It's comfort.
Mm. Well, you trust, you feel comfortable.
Yeah, so you're not threatened by not just the person who's saying it, but the idea. Mm-hmm. So let me put it this way. If the lights in the sky are angels or demons or whatever, then it hints at the awful possibility that there may be spiritual accountability and what those angels and demons are and how they may be connected to God. And right, that has all these implications. But if I say, no, the light moving across the trailer park sky or whatever is a rocket ship, I mean, a flying saucer full of, and I'm being facetious, but flying saucer full of little green aliens or gray aliens or whatever they are, little ETs that came from whatever planet 200 light years away, there's something that is psychologically or spiritually or morally not threatening about that to me, because they're to the modern mind, because there's no spiritual or no moral accountability, right? It isn't an angel or a demon calling me to accountability before a God. It's just an alien in a spaceship,
right? It shows a peculiar blindness of the modern materialistic mind, because what I was going to say is, yeah, and then the alien's no more threatening than, you know, a dog or a cat or a tree or any other part of creation.
Right.
But in the ancient religious mindset, especially that you see in the Psalms, all of those things drew our minds towards God and towards the accounting that we would have before him. So in order for that comfort that you're talking about to operate by, if we're explaining things as aliens, you already have to have drained your understanding of the universe of anything outside the material.
Let me bring it down to some practical things, right? So if the lights in the sky are angels or demons, then that has sort of implications about God and whether there is a God. And if there is a God, then what my moral accountability is and judgment and my eternal fate. And then all of this stuff happens coincidental to the breakdown of sexual morality and everything on the mid-20th century. So now all of a sudden, if there's angels and demons and they're coming and this and that, maybe my moral behavior matters. Maybe aborting children, I'm going to be held accountable to aborting babies or my moral behavior. But if they're little gray aliens flying around in a spaceship, they have nothing to say. They imply nothing about my moral behaviors. And in that sense, that's why I think they become sort of a more comforting mythology, because even though, again, there's no more evidence that light in the sky or whatever it is an alien in a spaceship than there is that it's an angel or a demon, but one is much more comforting morally and psychologically, I think, to the modern mind. I mean,
yeah, I think that's usually true.
Well, okay, we keep talking about angels and demons, so let's come to the last little part of this. Mm. And, you know, time is short here, but this is going to set up our next conversation here in the next episode. So let's talk about what some of these things could be. Now, I want to be completely intellectually honest. Maybe next week, the federal government is going to throw open the doors to the vault at Area 51 and bring forth the little craft and ET, maybe. But until I kind of see the flying saucer land in St. Peter's Square and the ramp come down and ET come waddling down and want to talk to the Pope, I'm going to just say I haven't seen anything that makes me think that that's true. Other than that, again, that's a mythology or an explanation that sort of fits, like, hey, there's a big universe and there's things and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Maybe people flew here. So I don't know, maybe.
We can see it as a possibility, but is by no means proved.
I have it's one thing to say it's not proved. There's a lot of things that aren't proved, but there's reason to believe they're true. I have never seen, and I've been looking at this stuff since I was in high school, I have yet to see anybody bring anything forward that would make me think that that's the case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these little clips of fuzzy things, and I mean, we can get into all the explanations, but I just haven't seen anything definitive. So, yeah, not only is it not proved, in my mind, it's not, there's no reason to believe it. But that brings us back to what are they? Right? Because there clearly are lights in the sky and weird phenomenon and things like that. And there always have been. And I, given my frame, I'm more inclined to think that they are of a supernatural origin.
Yeah, and I think there's a variety of possible explanations. I think it really has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. I don't know how much we can say in general about
there. Because obviously each case has to be like, this one might have been a weather balloon, or this one might have been a radar reflection. Because I know, like, I have friends that are into aerospace engineers and all that. And they said, you know, one of the things that's interesting is they started getting a lot more of these radar readings a few years ago when all of our military fighter jets got an upgrade to the radar. So the sensitivity of the radars went up. And so now you're picking up things that the radars wouldn't have picked up, you know, flocks of seagulls or, you know, whatever.
Sure, sure.
So anyway, who knows, right? You got to go case by case and go, this one was a flock of seagulls. This one was a weather balloon. This one we can't explain, right?
Right.
But let's suppose you eliminate all the ones that theoretically you can explain and you're left with some that are unexplained.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And the ones that are super weird and have no earthly explanation, then you get to this point where you go, well, then what are they? And it's interesting to me when you listen, because I listened to part of these congressional hearings, and the people who were testifying at the congressional hearings a couple of months ago, the supposed experts in UFOs, started to back off the whole, well, they're aliens from another planet that have flown here through 100 light years. And now their thing is that their new phrase is that they're non-human intelligences that either may have been on this planet before mankind and have always existed on this planet, but in hiding, and they occasionally reveal themselves, or they are creatures from another dimension that have not actually physically traveled here through 100 light years of space, but they exist in alternative and higher dimensions and occasionally sort of pop through into our dimensionality and reveal themselves and go back. And that these intelligences that are coming to us through other dimensional wormholes or coming out of the caverns in the earth or whatever, and something's getting pretty weird. As I was listening to the congressional hearings, because I watched part of them, I went, this sounds increasingly weirdly more and more like either Nephilim or angels or demons. And I'm getting personally creeped out by hearing about non-human intelligences that have been on this planet from the beginning and predate man and exist parallel to man that are now revealing themselves, or non-human intelligences from a higher plane of dimension that are occasionally revealing themselves to us. And these people were sitting in front of Congress saying, we need to contact them, or some people in the government are in contact with these non-human intelligences, and these non-human intelligences are giving our government guidance and wisdom to show us how to move forward to a better world. Now that starts super creeping me out. Way more than the idea of the aliens flying here, because that's starting to sound weirdly like angels or demons or Nephilim.
Yeah, it totally sounds like a sort of scientific explanation or a way of articulating something that is fundamentally supernatural, that it would be a spirit, a demon or an angel or what have you. Of course, there's a question of, you know, how accurate is what these whistleblowers are saying. Have they been lied to? Is it, as you were talking about earlier, a psyop for one reason or another, that there's nothing in particular happening, but it's to someone in the government's benefit that this confusion be out in the general public? I think that there's a spectrum that you can be on in terms of how you want to explain these cases that are not, that we don't have any scientific or material explanation for them. It's not a weather balloon or a flock of ducks or something. You can be at one end where you think that it's always or usually demons, that these are evil spiritual manifestations. You can be all the way at the other side that says that either it's nothing really, it's a lie, or that it could be other types of spiritual manifestations. And I think that it again, like we said before, it has to be assessed on the evidence. I think there's cases like what you're talking about that on the face of it sound much more demonic than a lot of other things where it's just like there's no particular reason to think this particular case is demonic. But then aside from particular cases, there's, I think, just how the enemy uses, what do I want to say, like intellectual or psychological trends and sort of memes out in the culture, cultural phenomenon, how he uses them, whether, you know, the material cause of a particular thing was it was a flock of ducks. How does Satan then make hay out of that in distracting people from God? And those are two different things. And it can be possible that no demon caused this thing, but the demons are going to use it because they'll use any tool that comes to hand.
Right.
And also the same can be said of God and his angels. They're going to try to use things that are happening in the culture in order to either draw people away from God or toward God.
Okay, as we wrap up this episode and segue to the next, I just want to squeeze two last thoughts in.
Yeah,
on this,
go for it. Because we could talk forever on this.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, the first is that I can't help thinking about a lot of scriptural things about angels and demons, right? Particularly demons, that Satan is a liar and everything he does is a deception. And then there's that wonderful line in the small formula, right? Mm-hmm. About Satan and all his empty show.
Right.
And part of it is that a lot of this becomes, in my mind, an empty show. It's a lot of razzle dazzle, distraction, look here, but nothing ever comes of it. And because of that, and because I know that Satan is a liar and it feels like a distraction away, I'm suspicious. Mm-hmm. And then I guess the second thing is that I think it's transcended a materialism. And when I listen to some of these UFO experts testifying with Congress about non-human intelligences that have always lived on Earth or coming through dimensional portholes or this kind of stuff, it sounds to me almost like a new paganism. Like they're just reframing supernatural beings into a sort of a new paganism. When I say a psyop, well, is it by the government or is it just sort of a new, in the beginning of the 21st century, there's kind of either a new paganism or a new Gnostic heresies that are sort of arising and this is how they present. And in that sense, it's a psyop because it is distracting Christians and turning their eyes away to something else.
Right. And there the difference, I suppose, is who's operating the PSYOP. Is it the government directly or is it
the government's advantage to give time to it right now, as opposed to a lot of other things that are going on in our society that maybe faithful Christians or Catholics would be very concerned about. And it's kind of like, hey, pay no attention to all the crazy stuff that's going over here because look, aliens.
Yeah. And I think there are other explanations of why it could be a psyop. The big one is that part of when the original alien phenomenon started was the beginning and the height of the Cold War. And it was partly a psyop against the Soviets to be like, hey, look, we've got alien technology, or at least we're making you suspect it. So don't mess with us. Right now, it's the Chinese and the Russians. So there are other explanations besides ones targeted specifically at Christians. But I think what you've said, it gives us the takeaway, is that don't be distracted by it. Yeah. That the fundamental purpose of your life is to know, love, and serve God. And if this helps in any way, then that's great and that's fine. If it becomes a distraction or if it is leading you away, whether from just influencing your worldview or taking up your time, or at the extreme, leading you into that kind of renewed paganism that you're referring to, then it's not good, regardless of whether there actually are aliens or not.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to stop here and we're going to segue into the next episode because we've been talking about angels and demons and that's the topic of our next episode. So come back in the next episode and learn about the Catholic teaching about angels and demons.
Yes.
Thank you for listening. My name is Greg Smith. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, would you please hit the like and subscribe buttons wherever you get your podcasts? And please share it with others. And if you're curious about the Catholic worldview and faith, the Church and its saints, or Catholic history, culture, and art, then visit consideringcatholicism.com. And email me to let me know what you think. Greg@consideringcatholicism.com.
You're listening to the Lunchtime Podcast Sampler on Catholic Radio Indy. I'm Kent Blanford, and we'll be back with more right after this. A little motherly advice from Marcy Rankin from CelebrateMarriageMinistry.com.
As a mother of six, it's easy to get distracted by the children. I enjoy listening to Catholic Radio Indy because it helps me remain centered in my faith. When I'm on the way to get the kids from school, or whether I am running errands every day, I can listen to shows like Dr. Anders talking about the richness and fullness of our faith, Dr. Ray Gurundi giving great advice and encouragement to parents and families, and as well as the Local Faith in Action program that features local people just living their faith in their daily lives. It's a great tool, and I hope that you can recommend it to all the moms that you know.
Do you like game shows? How about trivia? You're listening to Catholic Radio, so I assume you're interested in the Catholic Church. Catholic Challenge 2.0 is the newest addition to our programming lineup here on Catholic Radio Indy. A 30-minute quiz show covering almost everything Catholic. Catholic Challenge 2.0 tests your knowledge and teaches at the same time. Check it out every Thursday afternoon at 4:30 right here on Catholic Radio Indy. Often the question arises, why does God allow so much evil to exist in our world? The most basic answer comes down to the fact that God granted us the gift of free will. In our next offering on the sampler, Father Gregory Pine explores the gift of free will in this podcast from Pints with Aquinas.
Hello. My name is Father Gregory Pine, and I'm a Dominican friar of the province of St. Joseph, and this is Pints with Aquinas. This past weekend, I was in Nashville, Tennessee. Why? Well, because I went to visit the Dominican Sisters of St. Cecilia, because they were hosting a retreat for young women, a kind of come-and-see weekend, and so they had me in to preach some of the conferences, which was awesome. And the topic, or the theme for the retreat, was freedom, which is an awesome theme, especially in this setting, because I think that often enough, we feel our freedom to be a burden, or we don't know how to make sense of our freedom and then default on it, thinking that we have to, optimize or maximize in some kind of like crass robotic way. But it turns out our freedom is a great gift, a great responsibility, sure, but a great gift which ultimately helps us to partake of God's own freedom, which is wild. So let's talk a little bit about freedom. Here we go. Okay. So sometimes when people describe freedom, they describe human freedom as in conflict or competition with divine freedom. But I want to submit to you that this is not the case. So I would say it's more so true that our freedom is a sharing or participation in the divine freedom. St. John Paul II talks about this a little bit in the encyclical, which goes by the name of Veritatis Splendor. And he says that because of certain philosophical developments of like the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, people get it in their mind, right, that either I am autonomous, which is to say I am a rule to myself or a law to myself, or I suffer heteronomous imposition, right, or I suffer the effects of heteronomy, which just means like other law. And we think about it in terms of something that is violent or something that is oppressive or something that represents a curb to my freedom or a limitation on my freedom. But St. John Paul II proposes a kind of middle way, which he describes as participated theonomy. That is to say that when we abide by God's law, we partake of his very freedom, and we come to discover that it enriches and actually emboldens our own freedom. Why? Well, because God is the giver of our freedom, and the giver of our freedom on the pattern of his own. God works more interior to us than we work within ourselves, okay? So God is able to act more naturally in our own nature than we ourselves are. Because when you think about it, what it means for something to be free or for it to be voluntary is in part for it to issue from us, like to genuinely be from us. And when God acts in us, you know, prompting us, as it were, to consent to and cooperate with his movement, he makes it to be genuinely from us, not because he's the great puppeteer in the sky, but because he's the giver of our nature and the giver of our agency, and he sustains our nature and our agency and being throughout the whole course of our life, seeking to heal and to grow it with the gift of grace and ultimately to stabilize it in glory. So this makes it such that we have to rethink our understanding of freedom just a little bit. And so we're not thinking of freedom in terms of the capacity for license or the capacity to choose among various options without any condition or without any like limitation thereupon, because that's not the point. That might be what we would call a kind of freedom of indifference, but we're looking for a freedom for excellence. We're looking to be, again, emboldened or empowered in our pursuit of the good. And so in preaching to these women, I tried to identify a couple of like notes of freedom, which we can identify in the divine freedom, which then have application in our own human experience. And the things that I picked out were 1, fixity, and 2, play. What do I mean by that? Well, to be free is to be fixed in the end, in the sense that nothing can distract us from it or deflect us from it or otherwise deter us from it. Because the truly free person knows what he or she is about and is, you know, dead set on that pursuit. And in our case as Christians, that's God. I mean, the goal is God. You can think about it in terms of holiness or sanctity or consecration, however you want to describe it in this setting, right? But ultimately, what we're seeking to be fixed in is God himself. And we see this, you know, in God's dealings with creation. So God creates everything, you know, by his love, on the pattern of his love, and unto his love. So in all that God does with creation, he does it for love. He is fixed in himself, who is love, all right? And then this other idea of like play, namely that when you are fixed in the end, it doesn't matter too terribly much what you use as the means, okay? Because again, it's not about optimizing or maximizing, because we're not just trying to produce effects or consequences. We're trying to grow in love, right? We're trying to affirm the object of our love, in this case, God. So like if you're truly fixed in the end, it doesn't matter if you go in for A or B or C, if these various options can all be a way by which to affirm that end itself. And so the example I used in preaching was like gelato. You come to find this excellent gelateria when you're visiting a friend in Rome, and you try the first flavor, and it's like, oh my gosh, this is delicious. Pistachio absolutely lights out. And you decide to go there the next 2 or 3 days during your stay. And it's like, yeah, they have 99 flavors. You can choose any number of them. It's going to be great. You know, you don't have to lament the fact that you can't try them all, nor do you have to make an exhaustive study of the potential benefits or like drawbacks of each flavor. It's just like, no, just enjoy, because you're there to love your friend and you have found a way to do it together, namely eating gelato because it's wonderful, and let's go, right? That's the idea. So we also see this play again in God's dealings with creation, and we can think here specifically of the plan of redemption. So God, you know, created this world. He could have created another world, but he created this world because he thought that this world might be a wonderful way in which for us to experience his love, because he found it to be a wonderful way to manifest his glory and work towards our salvation. Obviously, we defected from that purpose. We sinned, our original parents sinned, and we ourselves are downstream of that choice. But in the plan of redemption, God, again, could have done any number of things, but he chose what he chose, namely, that his only begotten Son take human flesh, suffer, die, rise from the dead, and lead us with him up to life eternal, because it's wonderful, because it's beautiful, right? So God could have snapped his fingers and effected our salvation by a seemingly more immediate or direct means. But he chose our Lord Jesus Christ as the means which was most fitting, or, yeah, again, most wonderfully or beautifully suited to communicate the depths of his love for us, yeah, and the horror of human sin, but then also like our dignity as human persons and then our destiny as partakers of his divine nature. So insofar as God is fixed in the end, which is himself, you know, the divine love, he is free to play with the means, both in creation and in redemption. And again, it's not for us to say like, well, maybe it could have been blah, 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 thus and such. I suppose that might be a fruitful avenue of speculation. But it's for us to kind of unpack the divine wisdom and the divine affection, which are told forth in the choice that he actually made. So then we're meant to participate or to share in this freedom, this divine freedom. So when you think about it, it's a matter of our being educated in a certain fixity and educated in a certain play. So fixity, we're seeking to affirm God in all that we do, right? We say that we realize this in learning to love, because love is the fulfillment of the law. And love of God and of neighbor abides by the same logic, which is the recognition that it's a gift, right? That we are here as a gift, that they are here as a gift, that God has given it as a gift, and that we can respond joyfully at the recognition and reception of this gift and enter into the ambiance of the gift, of its gratuity and of its liberty, right? Of its wonder, of its beauty. And so we seek to be yet more and more perfectly throughout the course of our lives fixed in the good God, fixed in the divine love. And then we are free to choose among the means. So in this particular retreat, I was talking about it with respect to vocational discernment, because I think a lot of people just kind of get hooked on, all right, you know, religious life is objectively higher, which it is, because it espouses objectively higher means to salvation. But we have to ask ourselves, what is subjectively mine? Right? What is the Lord calling me to? Because he's not about a bland egalitarianism of promoting everyone towards the objectively highest state, because it's not a bland egalitarian project. It's a mystical body. So we're each called to be small, to be humble, and to play our part, and come to discover by the Lord's kind of indication in our loves, which are gradually being healed through prayer, sacrament, study, penance, friendship, service of the material poor, and other things besides. We're called to discover where we fit. Right? Not so as to be ground under or passed over, but so as to abide in the place in which we are meant to flourish for God's glory and our salvation. And so with the recognition of that, we can kind of play with our loves, because if we're seeking to heal and to grow them, that is to say, to educate and edify them, and then they will lead us further up and further into the divine plan, that we can trust God because he has trusted us with our own life. He has placed our lives in our hands so as to see, in a certain sense, what we'll do of them. Again, not to optimize or maximize, not to like make an Excel macro, which will give indication as to the best possible way that we could produce, you know, wonderfully salvific consequences for all those whom we meet. Okay, I don't mean to make light of that, but sometimes it's good perhaps to think along those lines. But I just mean to say, like, the Lord wants you to love, and he's excited to see how you will love. So insofar as we are fixed in the end of God and seeking to be ever more so throughout the course of our life, we are genuinely free to play with the means, right? You might enter religious life. You might not. You might get married. You might not. You might marry this individual or that individual or someone else entirely. You know, it's like any number of things could happen. And in the midst of those different things, the Lord is present. Right? The Lord is welcoming you into a deep relationship with him so that you might encounter and experience that divine intimacy, so as to make a certain sense of your life and to render it precious. So I think that rather than envisioning our freedom as in conflict with the divine freedom, we can see our freedom as a partaking or sharing in the divine freedom, that we can have a foretaste or a forexperience of the divine fixity and of the divine play, and that our freedom, which maybe perhaps we formerly thought of as a kind of burden, becomes in turn an opportunity to express the divine joy, the divine levity, the divine excitement at the prospect of how his glory can be told forth in the orders of both creation and redemption with wonder. So it's like in that setting then that we talk about freedom in the particular terms that we describe it in, and like, you know, it's like the metaphysical tradition will say that you can choose whether or not, right? Or you can choose under this or that aspect. And that's all super helpful in making those distinctions. But I think that this fundamental point, this most basic point, that there's not conflict or competition, right? That there's a genuine share, that there's a real participation. So rather than going in for autonomy or heteronomy, we have this middle way, which is to say this higher way of participated theonomy. All right, so we can receive our freedom as the gift that it is, and learn to exercise it with greater delight, right? to exercise our freedom with greater freedom. That sounds like we're just defining things by themselves, which gets out of control. But this is God's plan for you. This is his intention for you. This is his delight for you. All right, that's what I wanted to say. This is Pints with Aquinas. If you haven't yet, please do subscribe to the channel. Push the bell. Get email updates when other things come out. Also, if you haven't yet, check out God's Planning, which is a podcast which I contribute with four other Dominican friars. Things are moving and grooving on the God-splitting front. We just recorded a handful of episodes, some of which are quite good. I'm pretty pumped about them. We hope to hear from you in that platform or on that platform. And then we have a God-splitting retreat coming up for young adults aged 21 through 33. Send an email if you're slightly older, and we'll make an exception. But we've got like 70 people signed up, so we're pretty jazzed, getting on towards capacity. So that's November 3rd through 5th in Malvern, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. And it's about as cheap as it gets, insofar as I think we're only charging like $225 for a shared room, $275 for a single. So find out details about that at godsplaining.org. All right, know of my prayers for you. Please pray for me, and I'll look forward to chatting with you next time on Pints with Aquinas.
That's all the time we have for Catholic Radio Indy's Lunchtime Podcast Sampler for today. You can find this show in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org, along with links to more of the programs we've shared. I'm Kent Blanford, and until next time, may God bless.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.